Hyperion to a Saturn.
Welcome to the 15th episode of Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Podcast Network's Hamlet podcast. I'm your host, Siskoid, your guide on a scene-by-scene, deep-dive look at Shakespeare's masterwork through the lens of not only the text, but many film, television, comics, and music adaptations. And today we continue Act 2, Scene 2 with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern's interaction with Hamlet. In this next sequence, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern finally catch up to Hamlet. Though in the guise of old school chums, they are really there at the king's behest to spy on the prince. This does not mean they have to be sinister figures. They may, in fact, have Hamlet's best interests at heart, as does the queen who first sent for them, but they do find themselves at cross purposes with Hamlet. It's perhaps telling that their conversation is not in blank verse. Scenes with Horatio, who has a similar relationship with Hamlet on the surface, school friends, are still in verse. Do RNG not rate the heightened language of the court? Where Hamlet treats Horatio as an equal, and at times even a better, he talks down to RNG, bringing himself to their level, and basically running circles around them. It may be interesting to note that when RNG do speak in verse, to the king and queen, for example, they do so at their own peril, paranoid and halting in their delivery. This is a world they aspire to, but which is forever out of reach. Hamlet has outgrown them. This is at odds with comments I've made earlier, where I wondered if they were courtly friends, which is why they were tagged by the royals, while ignored Horatio was of lower class. Because again, note the lack of Horatio here, and through all of Act 2. If all these guys were at university together, and certainly RNG went to the same theaters and so on, you'd have thought they all knew each other. But the one scene where they almost share the stage together, Act 3, Scene 2, Horatio immediately goes quiet when RNG re-enter to summon Hamlet to the queen, and they don't even acknowledge each other's presence. And then Horatio disappears again until Act 4, Scene 5. He might be lower born than RNG, even though he's closer to Hamlet, so they won't acknowledge him and he won't speak until spoken to. Or maybe they just resent him because he is closer to Hamlet. But there's no dialogue to that effect. More fuel for those who think Horatio is somehow a figment of Hamlet's imagination. And since only Horatio and the characters Horatio speaks with see the ghost, it's a good way to compartmentalize the hallucination. But let's assume this isn't Fight Club and everyone is real. I would say RNG grew up with Hamlet, whereas Horatio is someone he met at university. Different kinds of friendship. He's grown away from his friends from Elsinore and found more in common with someone he met as an adult. The dialogue does sum up the duo's place in Denmark. They describe themselves as the indifferent children of the earth, happy in that we are not over-happy. On fortune's cap, we are not the very button, nor the soles of her shoes. Neither, my lord. They have a tenuous connection to the royal family, but have not yet managed to rise to the inner court, which they aspire to. This is their shot. They'll go on to wonder why Hamlet, who to them is at the very top of the social scale, feels that he is at the bottom. Then you live about her waist, or in the middle of her favors? Faith, her privates we. In the secret parts of fortune, oh, most true, she is a strumpet. It amuses me that this coarse joke has been removed from my pocket copy of the play, published for use in the schoolroom. Beyond the joke itself, it is telling that Hamlet considers Fortune to be a whore who raised his murderous uncle to the loftiest position in the land, and in so doing, makes a statement about his own mother, who let Claudius climb on top of her. It continues Hamlet's motif of linking adultery and sexual sin to the female principle. What follows is Hamlet's description of Denmark as a prison, which we may well find foreshadows the final fate of RNG, so long as one imagines a short stay in a dungeon before their execution. Their opinion on the matter? Why then your ambition makes it one? 'Tis too narrow for your mind. I've often found that people ascribe their own motivations to others. Those who act in bad faith assume bad faith on the part of others, and vice versa. How RNG interpret Hamlet's words tells us more about their own thought process than Hamlet's. They're motivated by ambition. He's not. It does beg the question as to whether they believe Hamlet should be on the throne by filial right. Are they fishing for answers and testing their own theory for Hamlet's distemper? And if that's their belief, the characters would be trapped between a rock and a hard place, trying to please both the pretender king and the would-be king, so as to stay in both good graces. Again, the idea that they are mid-level. Their death sentence is signed not by their choosing the wrong side. They don't know they're carrying orders to have Hamlet put to death, but for hedging their bets and not choosing a side at all. Except their own, I guess. They do argue that they aren't all that ambitious, though. I hold ambition of so airy and light a quality that it is but a shadow's shadow. And Hamlet responds, then are our beggars' bodies, and our monarchs and outstretched heroes the beggars' shadows. One of two connections made between beggars and kings in the play, Hamlet is consistently deflating his own royalty and that of others. It's part of the fatalism of the play, we all return to the earth in the end, as well as a slight on the current king. If he can be king, then anyone can. This particular line mirrors RNG's own ambitions, the shadows and dreams being their own. Hamlet likens them to beggars, which they are. They beg for attention, they beg for power. It happens again on the line, beggar that I am even poor in thanks. Hamlet confuses a royal for a beggar, in this case himself. The theme of this sequence will eventually bloom into What a Piece of Work is a Man, in which Hamlet dissects humanity itself in this way. By this point, Hamlet has rumbled his two chums and told them he knows they were sent for. He admits to his depression, at least, has this big speech, which we'll have cause to mention again, of course, and the exchange ends thus. Man delights not me, no, nor woman neither, though by your smiling you seem to say so. My lord, there was no such stuff in my thoughts. Why did you laugh, then, when I said man delights not me? To think, my lord, if you delight not in man, what Lenten entertainment the players shall receive from you, we coated them on the way. Good recovery, Rosencrantz. As part of the various inversions in this section of scene 2 is the change of tone, taking us from Hamlet's sublime and fatalistic speech to RNG laughing at what was essentially a gay joke. This is another sign that RNG aren't on Hamlet's level, intellectually or poetically. It also acts as a bridge for a conversation about Elizabethan theater. Hamlet is very much about a man putting on a play, and from here to the play within the play, it also becomes about theater itself. This section, along with the later speech to the players, gives us an idea of what Shakespeare's theater was like, but also tells us there was a lot of what he considers bad theater going on. But the sequence starts with Hamlet making an ironic comment in the context of his uncle's usurpation of the throne. He that plays the king shall be welcome. His majesty shall have tribute of me. As for theater critiques, are we to understand that Shakespeare, at this point in his career, felt the sting of competition? It's the same today. Things that are popular are not necessarily good art. It's what makes people hide behind the idea that quality is all subjective, when clearly it is not. Taste is subjective, but there is such a thing as objective quality. At the end of this often deleted conversation, Hamlet brings things back to his situation, comparing Claudius to bad theater, popular, but lacking in quality. It is not very strange, for mine uncle is king of Denmark, and those that would make mouths at him while my father lived give 20, 40, 50, 100 ducats apiece for his picture in Little. At the very end, Hamlet lets slip something of the truth. I am but mad north-northwest. When the wind is southerly, I know a hawk from a handsaw. It may be right to say that he lets down his guard exactly because the comment, at least to RNG's ears, is coded. It isn't the only time that Hamlet sounds mad, even as he tells us he isn't. Okay, on to the adaptations. In Branagh's production, RNG arrive on a small steam train, evoking their childhood friendship with Hamlet. Almost immediately, they fall into the sort of clever banter they used to indulge in with the witty prince. The setting also seems important. Meeting them outside Elsinore reminds us that they are outsiders to the court that they desperately want to be a part of, but exteriors also give weight to Hamlet's line about being king of infinite space, and his black figure against the snow connects Hamlet to the shadowy realm, which in his case would be his unrealized revenge, and also to the outstretched echo of a hero or monarch who is but a beggar, as he refers to himself soon after. Another reason to place this scene outside is to reveal RNG's duplicity. We have already seen them inside Elsinore. So their surprise arrival is a con. When Hamlet tells them their news is not true, it seems at first that he means the world's not grown honest, but it may just as well refer to their entire arrival.
What news?
None, my lord. But that the world's grown honest?
So there is doomsday near. But your news is not true. Let me question more in particular. What have you, my good friends, deserved at the hands of fortune that she sent you to prison hither?
Branagh plays Hamlet as emotional here. As soon as he calls out RNG on their fake news, his eyes start to water, perhaps in anger. He realizes early that he's been betrayed by childhood friends, and this emotion pours out when he confronts them about it, and he does so head on. I Have an Eye of You, scripted as an aside, is here a warning. Hamlet, in fact, uses his emotion to shame them into admitting their connivance with Claudius. He then seems to take them into his confidence, so the lie is out of the way, so to speak, but he may be playing with them. Branagh plays him as sometimes vulnerable, sometimes mad, sometimes angry, giving them knowing, ironic looks. For example, he starts, "What a piece of work is a man," while looking at Guildenstern, an edified man he will bring down in the course of the speech. He also looks at each of his friends, in turn, when he mentions the hawk and the handsaw, playing on the joke that the characters are nearly identical, but also saying that he knows friends from enemies. For their part, they don't quite know what to make of him, and where Horatio seems to be on the same page as the prince, their interactions are often inappropriate. They are old friends, in a very real sense, as opposed to longtime friends. They are only comfortable in nostalgia and otherwise awkward. They can handle banter and theatrical gossip, but they can't deal with Hamlet's depression or flights of poetry. This culminates in their turning one of the play's key speeches into a juvenile joke. They're chuckling, visibly insulting Hamlet. They revert to childhood when interacting with their childhood friend, or my own friends called revertigo. The theatrical gossip section is not often played, and Branagh wastes as little time as possible on it, making the rapid-fire discussion so quick, it's hard to really get any meaning out of it. So, why is it there? I mean, in the text. It, of course, tells us something about RNG and Hamlet. Thematically, they're also talking about pretenders, young actors coming on the scene and stealing the work of more established ones, their worthiness in question. Hamlet relates this to his uncle usurping the throne, and even getting the two suck-ups to laugh along with his joke, and condemns fashion for elevating both. And then there are the pretenders themselves, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, ironically trying to elevate themselves, like the boys of the speech did. So, while Branagh doesn't necessarily convince us that this section needs to be in the play, it does support many of the play's ideas. Now, since Olivier has completely excised Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, the sequence has gone with them, of course. We lose many key lines and one of the best-known speeches, and that certainly has an effect on the play. One might argue that Olivier plays clinical depression, or as it was known, melancholy, well enough that we hardly need the speech describing his mood, and indeed Olivier's adaptation is more dour for losing the witty banter between Hamlet and his school chums. We're left with a single line, spoken to Polonius when he comes to announce the players.
He that plays the king shall be welcome.
Olivier obviously thought it was important, and it is. It ironically sends up Claudius by replacing him with a more welcome pretender. But however little the effect on the particulars of the plot, one still misses the wit and poetry of Shakespeare's words. As is sometimes done to Horatio in Act 1, Jacoby's Hamlet gives his greetings to RNG before he even recognizes them. When he does, Rosencrantz, the jokester of the two, lets out a little pa-da that puts us in the frame of mind of a beaten friendship. Hamlet immediately subverts that, however, by mistaking Rosencrantz for Guildenstern, spinning both names at the same character to fix his mistake and getting an annoyed smirk from him.
Oh, just thou, Guildenstern! Ah, Rosencrantz, good. Lads, how do you both?
The friendship presented here has apparently been misgauged by the Queen. Hamlet is dismissive and distrustful of his so-called friends, and often plays the scene as an attack. He's in complete control and foils them at every turn. He tries to get sympathy from them, but doesn't get it, such attempts feeling like tests that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern failed to pass. Jacoby's Hamlet is mercurial as ever, moving through various emotions in order to give each line its own portent. There is a belly laugh at the fortune joke, immediately followed by a quiet moment when he calls her a strumpet, allowing the viewer time to see a connection to Hamlet's mother.
In the middle of her favors.
Faith, her privates, we.
In the secret parts of fortune. Oh, it is too true.
She is a strumpet.
He is wholly sarcastic when he says he's poor in thanks, giving no quarter to his false friends. Pun not intended. Nay speak, when he draws a confession out of them, is explicitly to prevent them from colluding. No asides for you, RNG. And the emphasis placed on thinking makes it so takes a more literal turn when he says there's a confession in their looks. There really isn't until he says there is, and then they break down. He's imposed his will on them. His thought has become reality. The emphasis on that line also makes it important for the whole of the play, which is indeed about a man trying to convince himself to exact revenge. Hamlet must first think of himself as an avenger murderer before it can become reality. That movement from thought to deed is what creates tension in the play. We'll note later how Hamlet accuses himself of violent thoughts, thoughts that only later are translated into deeds. Hamlet is a true Shakespearean character. He overhears himself, as Bloom would put it, and is transformed by his own words. Thinking things makes them so. Hamlet then goes on to anticipate their questions. He doesn't just know they were sent for, he knows why they were. The "What a piece of work is a man's speech" is read from his book, which is only a book of slanders if you believe Hamlet wasn't making up the earlier words to suit Polonius. A departure from most stagings. Here, they are not his words. He could never think of man in those terms. While it robs Hamlet of a poetic élan, it makes sense in the framework of his depression. The decaying view of the world, however, is really all his, spoken in reaction to what he's just read. "Man delights not me," right at the end, has his holding back tears in earnest. Which, of course, is exactly where Rosencrantz gets the giggles, all part of RNG's inability to gauge Hamlet or the situation. It's a well-done moment and sends us careening into the theatrical gossip segment and back into RNG's comfort zone. The sequence ends with them believing they are welcome in Elsinore despite Hamlet's earlier attacks. Zeffirelli, in addition to his many cuts, disrupts the usual order of the play at this point. From the fishmonger scene, he moves to Hamlet's arranged meeting with Ophelia, then to be or not to be, before finally moving us outside Elsinore for our first encounter with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Hamlet takes a horse ride and lays down on a carpet of greenery, all very idyllic, perhaps as an ironic counterpoint to his contention that Denmark is a pestilent prison. The director is keen to keep things as visual as possible, making cuts in the dialogue, which I personally find annoying because the visuals definitely don't replace the nuances of the text, nor do they always bring something to the film except a visual change of pace for the audience. For example, this sequence will move from this secluded spot to an open cabin facing the beach where the friends can have lunch. This does not perceptibly illuminate the nature of their relationship, and the way it's staged, I would say it even confuses it. RNG are played by Michael Maloney, who's Laertes under Branna and Hamlet in A Midwinter's Dream, and Sean Murray, respectively. They come upon Hamlet where he reclines, almost Christ-like, and in a change from the play, they are escorted by Horatio and young Marcellus. So what does this suggest? Have they been to Elsinore, had their meeting with the royals, and have now gone to look for Hamlet, and Horatio has been tasked with leading them there? Or does Horatio have a privileged relationship with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern? The former seems more probable than the latter. Without any lines, Horatio is basically there to look at Hamlet with sadness as his friend either bears his soul or lies to common friends. It's pretty ambiguous. Or to receive pregnant looks from Hamlet, as in the "What a piece of work is a man" speech, where the prince either acknowledges his friend's compassion or means to pass on the message that he's putting on a show for RNG. Hamlet's entire attitude towards RNG gets away from the usual idea of describing melancholy or depression. He's instead quickly angry at them for withholding their true intentions, something they admit to only after a show of violence when he kicks a stool from under Rosencrantz.
Be even and direct with me whether you were sent for or no!
My lord, we were sent for.
I will tell you why.
His delivery of key speeches is rather more venal than other Hamlets, as if to say, I'm not happy and there's nothing you can do about it, gents. He doesn't put on a particular show of madness, and the line about being mad north-northwest is cut in any case, but states his point of view matter-of-factly, and since most of the speech is spoken to Horatio, his back to the others, it can't even be said that he shows a moment of vulnerability to RNG. This follows an introduction in which Hamlet hardly seems to remember their names.
How dost thou, Guildenstern? Rosencrantz.
As I said, there are many cuts made to this sequence. Most of the playful banter between the friends is gone. Hamlet no longer welcomes them to Elsinore. He doesn't let slip any remark about his uncle. And of course, the theatrical gossip has been excised. Now the grubby players show up in a large wagon and Rosencrantz points at them. Zeffirelli then gets back to his visuals with a long sequence showing the troop enter Elsinore. Chronologically, in Hamlet 2000, RNG board Hamlet in a club after the To Be or Not to Be speech. They're played by Steve Zahn as Rosencrantz and Decan Thurman, yes, brother of Uma, as Guildenstern. Hamlet embraces these two wild and crazy friends, initiating a protracted boozer. Their idiosyncratic performances soon reveal them to be two different kinds of creep. Rosencrantz is manic, spinning on stools, making karate moves, and shouting through the music in a way that Hamlet simply never does. He's basically Steve Zahn. And meanwhile, Guildenstern is on the other end of the scale, listlessly resting his head on Hamlet's shoulder, his sexuality as relaxed as the rest of him. They come off as immature party lads, unable to grasp Hamlet's true nature.
What make you here?
Visit you, my lord! No other occasion!
The film retains the banter, spreading it across the night through time cuts, but cuts everything after it. Hamlet does not force these men to confess their allegiance to his parents. There is no "What a piece of work is a man" speech at this point, nor is there discussion of the players. Indeed, the film does away with the players and replaces them with actors on film. They're not characters in their own right. From this scene, we immediately move to R&D reporting to the royals by phone, a scene brought forward for comic effect. That sequence makes it clear that he does say some of the things that he does in the play, but only off-screen. The other effect is to keep 2000's Hamlet a more introspective character, who might know RNG are spies, but does not tell them he knows. Fodor's Hamlet is weaker than in any other version of the play, and this sequence shows how the director has undermined the character in a number of ways. First, of course, is how RNG, the play's notoriously weak characters, interact with him. Instead of fearful sycophants, we instead have bored, short-tempered louts. Hamlet is suspicious of them and antagonistic. He just caught them talking to the conspirators, after all, but gets no real reaction from them, except even more disdain and irritation. When accused, they meet outrage with outrage and shame Hamlet for being poor in thanks.
To think, my lord, if you delight not in man, what lent and entertainment the players shall receive from you? We coated them on the way, and here are they coming to offer you service.
The overall effect is that RNG are stronger characters than Hamlet. They win this skirmish. There's also the matter of Horatio, who is at Hamlet's side throughout this sequence. She not only has her emotions better under control than Hamlet does, sizing up RNG with, by turns, a steady gaze and the same kind of dismissive boredom, but she also borrows some of Hamlet's lines.
And is doomsday near? Because your news is not true.
And later, the question as to why the players are on the road. Hamlet is not a whole man in Fodor's vision. He needs to be completed by Horatio, where R and G are usually the two who are one and still don't measure up to a single Hamlet. Here, Hamlet must meet two with two, and he still loses the argument. Whether you agree with this idea or not, there are interesting things about the way Fodor stages the sequence. Until an accusation is actually made, each duo is never in the same shot as the other. They're separate, and in RNG's case, refuse to engage. Both groups look into camera, involving the audience in an unsettling way, very much what Fodor is going for throughout the film, which also possibly justifies his emasculation of the lead. And it also plays with the mirror effects inherent in the text. Reference to Denmark being a prison shifts our point of view to the ghost listening and turning his head. It's an intriguing piece of editing as it links the idea with that of Hamlet's father being trapped in a prison, a hellish state. Denmark is a prison to Hamlet, but it represents much worse to the ghost. Hamlet is also haunted by his child self, another ghostly character lurking about, though much happier, laughing behind potted plants and so on. A counterpoint to the prince's depressing vision of Denmark. The cut from confession directly into what a piece of work is a man, omitting further description of Denmark's putrid skies, turns the line's irony to straight sarcasm, and becomes the accusation that finally rouses RNG from their torpor.
What a piece of work is a man, huh? How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form, in moving, how express and admirable, in apprehension, how like an angel, in action, how like a god. The beauty of the world, the paragon of animals.
As often happens with cuts, it reveals an intent that is more ambiguous when lines are distanced from one another. It may thus be true to say that Hamlet always meant this speech to refer to RNG, two friends who have deeply disappointed him, not that Fodor in any way paints them as friends. Though some RNG pairings emphasize the betrayal, acting as somewhat sinister agents of the royals, the 2009 Tenet version, RNG, emphasized just how much they've grown apart from Hamlet. While he's an adult struggling with adult things, they are immature boys giggling at all the wrong bits and staring at their feet when things get serious. It's an extremely funny performance, even as the tension and discomfort mount. RNG are helped immensely by the editing, giving them reaction shots for many of Hamlet's lines. Instead of having the prince rattle on in an uninterrupted speech, there's the sense that RNG do indeed have lines, albeit silent ones. Pauses, stares, the putting of hands in pockets, hard swallows. This is where they live, in between the lines. And funnily enough, this is where Hamlet reads them, between the lines. And the discomfort is felt by Hamlet too. He's happy to see them, but before he can ever sense their betrayal, he visibly feels that they are no longer on the same page. Guildenstern's giggling during the fortune banter makes Hamlet uncomfortably stammer through the next line, desperate to change the subject.
And you live about her waist, or in the middle of her favours.
Take her privates, we.
In the secret parts of fortune. Most true, she is a strumpet. What's the news?
He's humouring them, but doesn't share in their mirth. It's also one of the few doctorish bits in the film. Tennant reins in a lot of his Doctor Who mannerisms in his performance, but these sometimes do slip by. It happens again at the end of the sequence when he starts acting crazy again, adopting a Cockney accent and making clicking noises when he delivers the hawk from a handsaw line, which you can easily compare to the you've had some cowboys up in here stuff of his doctor.
When the wind is southerly, I know an orc from an anshaw.
RNG are naturally dumbfounded at the depression speech, with reverse shots once again allowing the characters to be active witnesses. Tennant delivers the speech with obvious sarcasm. His voice breaking at the end makes RNG's giggles more inappropriate than ever. Rosencrantz actually lets out a little aha there, indicating that he thinks he's understood a meaning, finally. Perhaps that this was all a long joke about liking women, but he's, of course, wrong. One problem with the problem play is figuring out when Hamlet concocted his plan to stage a play that would catch the king's conscience. The speech in which he reveals it comes at the end of the act, but there are various points before then when Hamlet seems to be acting in accordance to this plan already. Tennant's Hamlet hits on this idea quite early. His expression when he hears about the players makes it clear he's already thinking about it, motivating the line,
"He that plays the king shall be welcome."
We'll see later if and how Tennant picks up the threads of this idea. At that moment, It gives him a boost of mad energy, and he starts acting the loon again. He strangely picks through Guildenstern's pockets, he crosses his arms before shaking RNG's hands, and he takes on accents. There are a few trims to the text in this section. The entire rhetoric of shadows, shadows, for example, is not used. Hamlet also doesn't reveal that he is most dreadfully attended, which is one of my favorite lines normally, because it is actually directed at them as bad friends, bad servants. None of these have any great effect on the play, however. The only outright cut is the usual decision to remove the theatrical gossip. Again, not a huge loss. Though in this case, it does make "It is not very strange for mine uncle is king of Denmark" something of a non sequitur, albeit one of many RNG have to react to. Comics-wise, the original Classics Illustrated omits this entire sequence, though RNG are characters in the comic. They're introduced at the scene's proper start and not seen again until after the play within a play. This allows the comic to avoid ribald pleasantries as well as the theatrical gossip, which were no doubt considered either inappropriate or irrelevant to the target audience. While the sequence does appear in artist Tom Mandrake's vision, it is cut for brevity. The effect is akin to jump cuts, moving the exchange along almost too quickly. The foppish RNG are discovered almost right away, Hamlet moving from dropping his book in joy to accusations in the space of a single panel. He then heads into his speech, still without RNG reacting. There's a cool visual link to "I have an eye of you" in one panel, showing an extreme close-up of Hamlet's right eye, his fingers hiding the left. It underscores the point of the page or sequence, Hamlet's piercing gaze uncovering the duo's duplicity. RNG don't even get to snicker at "Man delights not me" in this version. Hamlet volunteers, nor woman neither, without being prompted. The action is rather strangely staged on "Man delights not me." Hamlet seems to have a violent fit, motivated by self-loathing, but perhaps also hatred for his parents, man and woman. The line is made into an attack on the adulterous couple, turning into violence aimed at, or transferred to, RNG, and by extension, others like Ophelia. Hamlet once again changes his mood when he hears of the players, a change that seems even more extreme by virtue of the previous panel's violent intensity. And though the gossip is cut, the admission of partial madness is retained. RNG's lines suffer so many cuts that Hamlet is almost in soliloquy mode through most of the sequence. And since he has an audience, the soliloquy might be better called a rant. And finally, we have Johnny Hallyday's rock opera, where RNG's failed interrogation of Hamlet is represented by the song "Quel mal te bouffe," which means "What's eating you?" A short ditty sung by the choir, as Hallyday only sings Hamlet's parts, which is inappropriately, or for RNG quite appropriately, ridiculous sounding. Essentially, this translates as, "What's eating you? What's gnawing at you? Tell us, tell us." And Hamlet's answer, still in RNG's voice, "Angels, angels." The familiar vocabulary used is in line with RNG's usual depiction as people who do not connect with Hamlet's deep emotions. "What's eating you?" That reduces Hamlet's mal d'âme to a mild irritant. Hallyday glosses over the "what a piece of work is a man" speech in the last line, where Hamlet reveals, ambiguously because it's still not his voice, that he's bothered by angels. It's a bizarre response in the context of the song, but those who know the play can see a connection between this answer and the line "how like an angel." As sung by RNG, it's almost like they're claiming some kind of innocence in all this, again, tying into the irony of Hamlet's speech. Well, that ends our look at Act 2, Scene 2, Part 4. Next time, Scene 2 continues with the players' arrival in Elsinore. In the meantime, if you have thoughts on this particular episode, please head over to fireandwaterpodcast.com and leave them there. And if you like this content, think about visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/fwpodcast. Thanks for listening. I hope, dear listener, you'll return for Act 2, Scene 2, Part 5, The Players.
Rest is silent.